Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. Back with us on the programme is Jane Wenham-Jones, who's a well-known author and journalist who regularly appears on radio and TV. She's published six novels, including One Glass Is Never Enough and The Big 5-0. She's hosted the Romantic Novelist Association's Romantic Novel of the Year Awards for the last 10 years. She's now published two books on how to make it as an author, Wanna Be a Writer and Wanna Be a Writer We've Heard Of. The books feature insights and advice from agents, publishers and authors, including Joanna Trollope, Jill Mansell and Richard Madeley. Also with us is Jo Wilde, who's published a range of fiction, including historical novels as Joanna Courtney and contemporary fiction as Anna Stewart. Her latest novel, As Jo Wilde, Just the Two of Us, asks, what if the person you least want to be stuck with is the one you married? Jo wrote the book about a couple forced to be in lockdown together, whilst being in lockdown herself during the strict months of the pandemic restrictions in the UK. Also with us this evening is Elizabeth Chadwick, who's a member of an early medieval reenactment society with emphasis on accurately recreating the past. She also tutors in the skill of writing historical and romantic fiction. She's been shortlisted for the RNA Awards four times and won a Betty Trask Award for The Wild Hunt 30 years ago. The long-awaited prequel, The Coming of the Wolf, is out now and set on the Welsh borders in the mid-11th century. And finally, back on tonight's book show is Leah Lewis, who won Elle Magazine's annual talent competition with her contemporary love letter, #relationshipgoals, in 2015. Her second novel, Dear Emmy Blue, is about a girl who released a red balloon with a secret message hidden inside, which is found on a beach by a boy in France. That's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning, the pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Page before you open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibition, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Drench yourself. Words unspoken, live your life with arms wide open. Today is where your book begins.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Jane Wenham-Jones. She's a well-known author and journalist who regularly appears on radio and TV. She's written for a wide variety of magazines and newspapers, is a regular columnist for Women's Weekly and the Agony Aunt for Writing magazine. She's published six novels, including Raising the Roof, One Glass Is Never Enough, and The Big 5-0. We spoke quite recently on the book show chatting about that one. She's hosted the Romantic Novelist Association Romantic Novel Awards for the last 10 years. And she's back with us on the book show to talk about her two books, actually, on how to make it as an author. One is called Wanna Be a Writer, featuring contributions from over 100 authors, agents and publishers. And the follow-up, Wanna Be a Writer We've Heard Of, which offers advice on the next step and the road to fame and fortune. Welcome to the book show, Jane.
Hi, Hannah. Lovely to talk to you again.
Oh, it's great to have you back with us. Thanks for joining us, Jane. So talking about your two books then, Wanna Be a Writer and Wanna Be a Writer We've Heard Of. Great idea to put these together. How did it all come about?
Well, I am a sort of agony aunt for Writing Magazine, and I have been for a number of years. And I had this sort of idea that there are lots of sort of questions that people have just about the whole business of being a writer. And when I've been doing the column for a couple of years, and they're about 1,000 words each where I give advice on different aspects of the, you know, the whole industry and the whole process of writing, I thought, maybe I could turn this into a book. You know, I've got 24,000 words already. That would be easy. So I started to make it into a book, but in fact, you know how it is. Very few of the actual columns ended up there because I sort of wrote new material and changed it all around. But I interviewed about 100 different authors, agents, publishers, etc. for the book. And it was a really big learning curve for me as well, because I found out that everybody does it differently. And there are as many different methods as there are authors. I learned a lot. Hopefully other people will learn a lot, because you're getting everybody's wisdom, not just mine. And then Wanna Be a Writer We've Heard Of was sort of an actual follow-up, because there is a difference between being a writer and being one that, you know, actually has some success. So that's about sort of marketing.
Yes.
But the other reason I wanted to write about the whole business of it is because I was not an overnight success by any means. I finished my first novel in 1999, and I didn't find an agent for it. I mean, I didn't find an agent for that first novel at all at the time, and I didn't find a publisher for it for well over a year. And it was really dispiriting being just rejected and rejected and rejected. And I used to listen to other authors talking, and sometimes they'd make it sound as though it happened just like that. It really fell into their laps. And, you know, one minute they had an agent and they had six publishers fighting over them, and then they were sort of jetting off to the States to sell the screen rights. And sometimes I knew for a fact that that wasn't even the first book they'd written. But, you know, it was the third book. One very, very successful writer who's always in the bestseller list now wrote 11 unpublished novels before she broke through.
Wow.
You know, and all power to her elbow. And I made a hysterical pact to myself that if ever I got published, I'd be really, really honest about how long it took.
Yes.
So the book, Wanna Be a Writer, is part memoir and part how-to, in that I tell the mad story of how I got published. I mean, it was, I didn't actually start stalking, but I came close. I did all sorts of weird and wonderful things to get attention and to eventually get a publisher.
So did it work then, doing these weird and wonderful things?
Yes, eventually I got a 2-book deal. Yes, I got, and I'm now writing my 10th book. So,
fantastic.
Yes, it did work in the end.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because for so many people, there's a lot of people who feel like they have a book in them. And to actually take the time and make the effort and set the time aside to actually write that book is a big deal. So when people have made the time to do that, it's not over. Then you've got to find an agent and a publisher, and that can be really disheartening if it's taken you so many years to get that book out. To then not have anyone want to publish it must be really, really hard for people.
Oh, it's so hard. I can remember feeling just close to despair, really. You know, it's very, very hard. I mean, at least now there is always the option to self-publish, to get it out on Kindle, to hope that it gets enough interest that maybe you'll get picked up by a publisher later. I mean, that happens to authors these days. That just wasn't an availability when I started. I mean, you could self-publish, but it was vanity publishing and everybody knew it was. So, you know, you weren't advised to do that. Clue was in the name. but it is very, very hard because unless you're exceptionally lucky, you're not going to hit the big time doing it yourself. You do need a decent sized publisher behind you and an agent and all that that brings. So yes, it is hard, but we shouldn't confuse hard with impossible. And both books have, you know, as I say, a lot of anecdotes from other authors, and you know, I like to think it's inspiring and uplifting.
Yes.
And that it shows it can happen, and it does.
So the general, please correct me if I'm wrong, but the general rule, I believe, is when you've written your book, you need to find, or it's advised to find, an agent before a publisher. And in general, the agent will get you the publisher.
That's right. I would always recommend finding or doing your very, very best to find an agent first. Because an agent knows their way around the industry. They will be able to decide which publisher they should approach. They will understand the complexities of the contract. They can sell your book abroad, because quite often that's a very good income stream, selling your book to other countries for translation. So I would always say to people, first of all, take the time and try and get an agent, because if you've got an agent, then you can sit back and let the expert do the hard graft.
Yeah.
However, from my own point of view, I would also say, if you give it your very, very best shot to get an agent, don't give up. Because I got a 2-book deal with a very big publisher, part of Penguin Random House, and for my first 2 books. And later, I got an agent, and they were like buses, you know, 2 came along at once.
Yeah. So you can approach the publishers directly then?
Well, you can't in theory, but you can in practice. Some publishers do encourage submissions. What you need to do is pick which publisher you want to approach, go on their website, and somewhere there will be a little tab called submissions. And if you click on that, they will normally tell you what their policy is and what to do.
Yeah. Now, with regards to agents, I think publishing-wise, a lot of people, through being avid readers, will have heard of a lot of the big publishers, you know, Penguin, Random House, you named a few there. With regards to agents, most people, I guess, wouldn't necessarily have heard of different literary agents. How do people know which agents they should approach and why?
Well, this is where Google is your friend. I would Google a list of top literary agents in the UK. If you were doing it in the UK, or in America, if you were doing it in America. And there are like associations of literary agents. In the old days, we thumbed through the artists and writers yearbook.
Yes, yes.
But these days, it's online. And again, it's everything you need is usually on their website. But there's something called the Association of Authors Agents, which is a British voluntary trade association, and a lot of the top UK literary agents belong to that. And as anybody can set up as an agent, and they might not have a clue, I would start with that.
Okay.
Have a look at the list, and then visit each agent's website, see if they represent authors you admire, see if they cover your genres, have a look at what they want, because some of them will want a synopsis, some might just want the first chapter, some might want a letter in the first instance. See what they want and have a go.
Because all the information, as you say, generally is there on their website, and you can even click on specific agents within the agency that will tell you the kind of people that they're looking for, the kind of books that they're interested in taking on. So, because you could easily waste your time if you've written a memoir, there's no point sending it to agents that only do children's books or only do crime fiction or things like that. So it's worth taking the extra time to make sure that your book is appropriate to be sending to the particular people.
Absolutely. I mean, you really need to do your research. If you've got a finished manuscript, I would set aside a day and just relax and just sit on the internet and have a look, really good look around, and then make yourself a short list of agents that you like the sound of, and make sure that you do follow their instructions very carefully.
Yeah. Yeah. And would you recommend people sending out to, you know, lots of agents at the same time and sort of seeing what comes back, or doing one at a time?
Well, this is always a bit of a tricky one. The thing is, agents are very, very busy, and you might have to wait up to 3 months for a response. So if you do one at a time, I would, you know, you could lose up the rest of your life doing
yes.
it. So if it were me now, I'd probably send out to maybe 3 or maybe 6 to start with, and just see what feedback I get. The important thing is to be very honest if they ask to see the rest of the manuscript. So if they say, can I see the rest of the manuscript, and another agent's already reading it, be honest about that. You know, I mean, it's a good problem to have. But don't sort of waste people's time if it's, you know, somebody. And sometimes agents will say to you, I'd like to read the rest of it, but I've got to be the only one reading it for the moment, because they don't want to be, you know, reading, spending their time, and then they phone you up and make you an offer, and you say, actually, I've already gone with someone else.
Okay. So it's important through all the steps to be honest then, really?
Yes. I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
And the other...
Yeah, I mean, I've got some interviews with agents in the book who talk about the different, you know, their different attitudes to things.
Okay, great. And the other interesting thing you mentioned when speaking to various authors was that they all did it differently. And I'm fully aware of that, doing the book show for so many years and interviewing lots of authors. And there's no right or wrong way in how to write a book. I mean, some people literally just sit down and go, right, I've got to write another book. What shall this one be about? Then and they just start writing, and others will spend a massive amount of time planning and know exactly how it's going to end before they start writing. It's all very different for everybody, isn't it?
It is, exactly. And I always sort of, you know, cringe a bit when I hear very bossy creative writing tutors telling people how this is how you do it, because it's just not true. You know, I mean, I've heard tutors say, you know, you've got to do detailed character studies before you start. Well, I mean, I'd rather chew my own leg off than spend all that time doing detailed character studies. You know, my characters live in my head. But some people want to do that. I know author friends who do colour-coded spreadsheets and charts and all sorts of things, and other people, as you rightly say, just sit down and start.
Yeah.
It really, really doesn't matter, as long as you do it. The only hard and fast rule I would say is that if you really want to write, try and do it every day, even if you can only add a paragraph. You keep in touch with the manuscript and it grows a little bit all the time.
Yeah.
You know, doing a week at Christmas and then not picking it up again till June just doesn't really cut it. Once you've made that commitment to write a book, you need to keep at it.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I would say.
Absolutely. Good advice. Well, if people want to get more advice, they definitely need to get a copy of your books. There's Wanna Be a Writer and then the follow-up Wanna Be a Writer We've Heard Of. They're both by Jane Wenham-Jones, who we've been chatting to today, and you can get them from our website on tre.radio. Jane, thanks ever so much for joining us again.
Oh, it's really nice to talk to you again, Hannah. Thank you very much for having me.
The Book Programme. presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Jo Wild. She's published a range of fiction, including historical novels as Joanna Courtney and contemporary fiction as Anna Stewart. But she's with us on the book show today as Jo Wild to talk about her latest book, Just the Two of Us. And it poses the question, what if the person you least want to be stuck with is the one you married? Welcome to the show, Jo.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for joining us. So you wrote this book and edited it all within 6 weeks during lockdown.
That's right. Yes, it was. it was pretty crazy. That's the fastest I've ever written a novel.
Gosh, that's seriously impressive. Well done.
Thank you.
You made good use of your time.
I know, I didn't do any Zumba though, so, you know.
So this is a really interesting idea. It's obviously people did literally face this situation, being in lockdown, being stuck in the house with whomever they lived with. And, you know, for some, it potentially wasn't a great experience.
Correct. And actually, interestingly, I've been contacted by several people telling me that the scenario described in the book is one that was sort of fairly familiar to them and luckily had relatively positive outcomes. I think it's quite interesting that sometimes you can be living with someone and spending a lot of time basically avoiding them, and sometimes perhaps what you need is to actually face each other and talk some stuff through, which I guess is what we explored in the novel.
Yeah, it's a really interesting idea. So it's about Julie and Michael, who've been married for 34 years, staying together through thick and thin. And then lockdown happens. And initially they think, oh, my goodness, how are we going to cope with this?
Correct. Yeah. In fact, Julie, to be fair, has gone as far as actually sort of talking to a lawyer about divorce papers, and indeed at the start of the novel is bringing the papers home to start the conversation when lockdown hits, and she decides perhaps now is not the time to talk about it and hides them away in the drawer, and bit by bit as the novel goes on they start to open up to each other.
Can you tell us a bit more, or will it give it all away?
I suppose, in all honesty, the scenario is one that I think an awful lot of us who've been in long-term relationships will recognise, which is that particularly with having brought up three children, they've just grown apart and got too busy with various things that perhaps don't include each other. And once that's stripped away from them, and they hope that one or more of their children will come back to enjoy lockdown with them, but are disabused of that notion, so end up just the two of us in the house, hence the title. And I think we tried to explore through the novel via flashbacks to their sort of long marriage. Like I say, they've been married 34 years, which is a good long time. And we tried to structure it so that the initial flashbacks are to more problematic times in their recent past. And bit by bit, they unlock some of the happier memories from the past. And perhaps that's what enables them to start to look at what went wrong and how two people who are desperately in love and marry each other, hoping that it's going to be happy ever after, can grow apart from one another. So I think, like I say, it's not an unusual scenario, but hopefully lockdown presented a slightly unusual way in which to approach it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can see why it's can be a common thing if people have spent, you know, most of their married lives revolved around the children, you know, if they have a family, and then when the kids grow up and leave the home, suddenly it's just the two of you, and you realise that most of your life, or married life, have been about children, and suddenly it's just the two of you again. It must be a very strange thing.
Yes, and actually, I mean, to be honest, I have, my youngest is 16, so, you know, I'm I'm in the area, and we had during lockdown, obviously I had someone who should have been doing GCSEs, my daughter should have been doing A-levels, my stepson had to come back from a wonderful year doing a ski season in Canada, so I had them all kicking around the house again, and there's no doubt about it, when children are around the house, there's a lot of life and a lot of busyness and a lot of things to distract you from each other. So I think, I guess, one of the lessons we have to take is that it's important to try and keep an eye on each other all the way through, but that's certainly something that Julie and Michael, for various reasons, have failed to do.
Yeah, and easy to be kind of apart in your own home just because you're living together. Yeah. As you said, it doesn't mean that you're spending a lot of time together. A lot of couples are sleeping in different bedrooms, but also doing different things with their time, you know, in different rooms, watching TV or reading a book, or, you know, not always sharing time together in the same room.
No, that's true. And I mean, we have such a wonderful variety of opportunities available to us these days, don't we? Have so many brilliant activities that we can do, and hopefully we have all got friends that we can do separate things with. And obviously I think our children these days live probably busier lives than they ever have done, with certainly with mine, with sport and with their social lives, and people have kids doing lots of music and all that sort of thing, and on the whole we have to run them around to them. They're perhaps less able just to walk to things than they used to be in previous eras. So you end up barely seeing each other until the end of the night. And that can make it very easy to grow apart and become involved in things rather than each other. So yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of a product of our busy modern lives, isn't it? And one of the fascinating things that lockdown did was to literally strip all that away from all of us and leave us with just each other and just time to fill, which was difficult, but also I think in some ways quite positive. And I think a lot of families have said that it's, you know, been interesting to not be rushing around quite so much. I mean, for example, we've sat down during lockdown eating dinner at 7 o'clock every evening, all of us together, and I don't know when the last time we did that was, because usually everyone's rushing around to different things.
Yeah, I really think it hopefully has brought a lot of families and couples together more.
I hope so. I mean, I'm sure there's a little of the other, but I do think, and to be fair, I think there was, although obviously it's all been a very, very difficult situation, there has been a lot of positivity, and people certainly here in the UK going out and clapping for the NHS and seeing their neighbours more than quite often we do, which is ridiculous, really. And yeah, spending time with each other without quite so much pressure to rush around and always be at things and be planning the next event and doing the next piece of work. So yeah, it's been a tough time for many people, particularly anyone who's been directly affected by the virus, but also perhaps in some ways a chance to reflect on life a little.
Yeah, definitely. And when you're writing a book like this about relationships particularly, or marriage or whatever, is it difficult to kind of not let it have an impact on your life, either by when you're writing scenarios, I know it's fiction, but to either kind of think, oh, I mustn't make that mistake in my relationship, or we must do more of this, or do you know what I mean, in either way?
Yes, I suppose so. It does make you think a little bit as you explore someone else's problems, even if they're problems that you've made up yourself. It does force you to go back and think, and hopefully the same for readers. Certainly, I know when I read various books, they often set trains of thought going for you, don't they? So hopefully this one will help people to appreciate what they've got.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you've written books under various names, Joanna Courtney and Anna Stewart as well. Are they all very specific genres as to why you have the different names?
So my historical fiction in particular, Joanna Courtney, I write, well, it's not just historical, but it's sort of 1066 and earlier. So it's, for the want of a better word, medieval history. So I think when I started writing contemporary fiction, I was quite keen that readers didn't pick up a book expecting the Battle of Hastings and got a sort of contemporary love story. So it was quite important to keep those two separately. Anna Stewart is not dissimilar to Jo Wild, but publishing wise and for various contractual reasons, it was just better to write it under a new name, and its name I quite like. I am Jo, so Jo Wild is good.
Yes.
So it's getting interesting. I've got a lot of lots of names to juggle. It's like getting married every time. You have to practice your signature again.
Yes, I bet. And I think it's interesting, talking about history and your historical books, 1066, and looking back at medieval history, what is happening now and what has been happening in 2020 with the whole coronavirus thing? It's really interesting to imagine and realise that in years to come, children will be studying this in school, what we all went through and how terrible it must have been.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I think why I love history, and actually if you ask my friends, they'll tell you that I usually know far more about what was happening 1,000 years ago than I do, you know, at the moment, because I'm just fascinated by it. And one of the reasons, I think, is because on the whole, the episodes you study in history have, at least to some extent, finished. So you sort of know how they've turned out. So 1066, for example, we know how that turned out, and I find that interesting, and as a writer it's useful because it has a perfect shape that I can explore. It has a dramatic arc, if you like, and it's going to be very interesting what they study and where this ends up, because unfortunately I don't think it's over yet, is it? And hopefully in a while it will be over and people will be able to study it and say this is what happened then, in the same way as many people have been talking about, like, the Spanish flu of 1918 as a comparison, and they'll study it as a complete impact with where we see everything that's happened to the economy and to international relations and to travel and to all those things that at the moment are still so scarily amorphous to us.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to know what they make of it.
It sure will. Well, it's lovely to chat with you, Jo. If people want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called Just the Two of Us, and it's available to buy on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section there, and it's by Jo Wild. Jo, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Talk Radio Europe.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Elizabeth Chadwick. Much of her research is carried out as a member of an early medieval reenactment society with emphasis on accurately recreating the past. She also tutors in the skill of writing historical and romantic fiction. She won a Betty Trask Award for The Wild Hunt about 30 years ago and has been shortlisted for the RNA Awards 4 times. She's with us on the book show to talk about the long awaited prequel to her best-selling first novel, The Wild Hunt. It's called The Coming of the Wolf. Welcome to the book show, Elizabeth.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. And has it been strange to go back to The Wild Hunt, doing a prequel to a book you wrote 30 years ago?
Not really. It's strange. I suppose the strange thing is that I write probably about real people now, so that there's far more research involved, because I can't take my protagonists where I want to take them. You know, that I've got to follow their life stories. And the Coming of the Wolf is one where I could let my imagination, well researched, but just go where it, a bit more where it wanted, had a bit more freedom to range. But I was actually pushed into writing this by my readers. I originally wrote The Coming of the Wolf as a very young woman with a small family, and I sent it up to agents and editors, and I got a rejection from a particular agent. I sent it up where, and it said dealing with adult fiction, but my idea of what adult fiction was and the agent's idea of what adult fiction was were in slightly different areas, I have to say. So after that, I put the book aside and got on with The Wild Hunt, which went on to become a major award winner. But The Coming of the Wolf always felt somehow like unfinished business, and I eventually began rewriting it for a modern computer. I'd written it on an old Amstrad green screen, and the software didn't exist anymore. So I decided that, yeah, come on, let's put it on Word, because there's nothing to lose. And I put the first couple of chapters as freebies onto my website, and said, this is one I wrote, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago. What do people think? And it was like, where's the rest of it? Come on. And of course, I'd now got a full-time career writing other things. So I just had to carry on editing and putting bits of The Coming of the Wolves up as and when I had time, which often I had long spaces in between. But the readers kept saying, is there any more of it? Where is it? And I finally got it finished in a gap between novels, sent it up to my UK publishers, and they said, we like this, we'll publish it. So I really owe this book to the readers who made me do it.
Yes, that's lovely. I mean, you can't ask for a better reaction, can you, from your readers demanding that
absolutely
you write
not
more?
Yes, it was like, where's the rest of it? Come on, and why isn't this published? And
yeah, fantastic.
Get on with it. In fact, the two most vociferous readers have got a dedication in the book for keeping me up to the plate.
That's lovely. So tell us about the protagonist, the main sort of story of a little bit about The Wild Hunt before we look at The Coming of the Wolf.
Well, The Wild Hunt was set in the Welsh Marches in the closing years of the 11th century, early years of the 12th. And it's about a marcher, marchers being the area between England and Wales, which were always in dispute about who owned them. And it's about a young man who's forced into a marriage with a young woman, and neither wants to marry the other, but there are all sorts of conflicts that mean that they have to pull together if they're going to survive. And so it's about adapting to each other. He's already got a Welsh mistress, and that comes into the mix, and it's a big learning curve for everybody concerned, with lots of derring do and medieval swashbuckle, but also with a firm historical background. It's set against the death of an English king called William Rufus, who was shot in the New Forest with an arrow. Nobody knows whether it was accidental or deliberate. And his brother Henry I, who became King Henry I, took over, and he was quite a ruthless type. And it's about juggling the politics of the region as well.
Mm. So there's a lot of fact in there. There's a lot of actual things that happened.
Absolutely, yes. All it's the background is completely authentic. What it is that the characters are imaginary and stitched into that background as a different coloured thread, but they interact with the politics and with the people of the time. So although the actual names of the core places, the castles where they live, are imaginary, it is, for example, I use the castle of Ludlow as a, I had that in my head, although I don't call it Ludlow in the story. It's sort of a hybrid, if you like. But the actual storyline is imaginary, but it could have happened.
Yeah.
I tend to ask myself when I'm writing, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is this to have happened? And if it's between an 8 and a 10, I'll go with it. And if it's less, then I'll do further research or find a way around.
Yeah.
That's part of the fun of writing. It's doing the jigsaw puzzle.
Clever. And looking at the prequel then, The Coming of the Wolf, presumably it has the same characters, just earlier.
It's a generation earlier. It explores the heroes, how the heroes' parents came to meet and deal with their own issues and difficulties, because this is the period now immediately after the Norman Conquest, when the whole country is in a state of flux. And again, it's set on the Welsh Marches. Normally, when you have stories set in the period of the Conquest, you have Normans versus English, and that's the main conflict. And I thought, well, if you set it on the Welsh Marches, you've now got Normans versus English versus Welsh, and you have a triangle, and that makes for a lot more drama and conflict. Just before the King Edward the Confessor, in the reign of Edward the Confessor, should I say, there was a lot of trouble on the Welsh borders, and Edward the Confessor invited Normans over to come and settle, build castles along the Welsh borders, and settle in the country. So I had my heroes, Miles Le Gallois, which means Wiles the Welshman. I made his father a Norman who came over to take over one of these castles and marry a lady of the Welsh nobility. So now you have a man who's half Norman, half Welsh, and a heroine who's English, and you can bring in all sorts of interesting dynamics. And I deliberately set it there because you could work with that triangle rather than just having it English versus Norman.
Yeah. And is there a lot of information out there, both in books and online, about this particular period of history? Obviously, you mentioned that the Norman Conquest, most people will know a little bit about, at least 1066 and the Battle of Hastings. Yes. But other than that, I question how much people would be able to tell you about the 11th century. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, yes. There are books, there is quite a lot of information about it, but you have to dig.
Mm.
And I love the digging. But then my job is to make that, what I distill from that, to turn it into a novel that people want to read. And I always see myself as a bridge between the past and the present for the reader. So you've got to bring that past to life in a way that's as immediate as now, but which doesn't distort the past. And that's part of the juggling act.
Yes, quite a skill. I think it's very clever what you do.
Oh, well, it's I suppose just what I do. You know, I enjoy doing it. It does come to me fairly easily. I think it's something I can do, and that without blowing my own trumpet is what I'm renowned for.
Mm.
But for example, I quite enjoy sewing, but I'm rubbish at it. Everybody has a skill that they're particularly good at, and
yes.
I just happen to be lucky enough to be able to earn my living from doing it. You know, if I had to earn my living from sewing, even though I like doing it, I wouldn't.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there has to be a good story in there. I mean, we can equate it to learning history at school. You know, if you have a really boring teacher and it's just about memorising dates and who
Absolutely.
Was killed when, it can be really rather dull. But if you can bring these moments to life through great stories and talking about people and how they lived and what life was like, these time periods come alive.
That's right. It's us as we were then, basically. Society changes, technology changes, but we're still wired the same way. You see the same things happening in circles again and again and again. So you bring the dramas and the conflicts to life of the people's stories, and that's what I aim to do. So they will think in terms of their own medieval mindsets, but you can still understand a lot of that, because they have, you know, a lot of the same emotions.
Do you find yourself getting kind of so immersed in the period of history that you're writing about that when you stop writing or have a break and are kind of back into the real world, everything seems strange? You know, the differences, I mean, you mentioned technology, that has to be one of the biggest differences between the 11th century and now. Do you
Yes.
sort of find yourself thinking, hold on a second, where am I? Where's my mobile phone? What's going on?
not really, actually. I've always been able to switch writing on and off like a tap. That's another of my foibles. So it's almost like I come out of my computer, I go out of my writing room, and it's just like going into a different room, but a room that is so familiar.
Yeah.
That it's just another part of life. It's all like going out into the garden. You know, where you might be looking at your flowers and at green, and then you come back in the house and it's carpet, but it's the same. It's all part of you.
Yes, yes.
A friend said to me, it was a historian friend. She said, "You have become a native speaker, not a tourist, in terms of the medieval period." So, although I'm a very strongly aware of the differences, I don't tend to, you know, get phased by them. One of the things I do creatively is to use music for some of my inspirations. I will listen to quite modern pop and rock and take out the emotions in the sound of the music and the lyrics, and they go into my subconscious for, you know, when I'm writing the novel. Although it's set in the Middle Ages, there's modern rock music coming in. As far as I recall, I can't remember because it's that far back what I used for Coming of the Wolf, but I can remember in The Wild Hunt, for the bit where the hero had his Welsh mistress, that I used Bryan Adams' Run to You as one of the songs.
Oh, fabulous.
You know, because of the lyrics, you know, she's got a heart of gold, she'd never let me down, sort of thing.
And yes.
But you're the woman that keeps me coming round. I mean, that changes as the novel goes on, but for that moment, what he was feeling, I thought, oh, that's Bryan Adams' Run to You, isn't it?
Oh, brilliant.
So modern gets mixed up with ancient all the time. It's just an entire thing.
Yes, brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Coming of the Wolf, it's available to buy on our website in the bookshop section on tre.radio. It's by Elizabeth Chadwick, who we've been chatting to today. Elizabeth, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Leah Lewis to talk about her latest book, Dear Emmy Blue. We had her on about 6 months ago talking about her debut novel, Somewhere Close to Happy. In 2015, she won Elle Magazine's annual talent competition with her contemporary love letter, hashtag relationship goals. Welcome to the show, Leah.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for having me on again. It's nice to be back.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's great to have you back with us. It's not often I interview an author in 6 months after the last interview because they've had another book out. That's impressive, Leah.
Oh, I know. It feels, it always goes so quickly, but at the same time, it always feels like 100 years ago all at the same time. It's nice when you get the hardback, because with Somewhere Close to Happy, I had the hardback out in June of last year. And then I think I spoke to you when I had the paperback out around, it would have been about 6 months ago. So yeah, it's nice. It's really nice.
Yeah. So have you had a busy few months then, despite lockdown and everything? Have you been working away?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've had the kids home because I have three children. So we have the three children home. My partner is upstairs working and I'm downstairs working. It's all a bit crazy, but just starting to come to the tail end now, where my the current book I'm working on is starting to wrap up and I get to do nice things like this. So yeah, that's a nice sort of bit of payoff.
So Dear Emmy Blue comes from an idea, something that you had always dreamed about. This is the whole message in a bottle scenario.
Yes it is, except with the balloon. I'm not really sure when it started. I remember our school, when I was about nine, had a balloon release to celebrate a birthday, so the school had turned like 50 years or whatever, and we all had to let go of a balloon and put our name and school on the tag and to see if anybody would find it. And I think it was just from that moment, and nobody ever did find mine, but I think I kind of took that through life with me, that memory, and just the thought that someone could find it. And it's the same with message in bottle, and it's just that idea that something like that could bring two people together that could perhaps or would have never ever met in other circumstances. And yeah, I've always sort of liked pen friends and pen pals, that kind of thing. It's something I had for a really long time, just one of those things that floating around in my brain. And then push come to shove, I had to sit and think, well, how could I turn this into a novel? And yeah, it all sort of just happened.
So tell us about the character of Emmy Blue.
Emmy Blue is, she's just about to turn 30, and she isn't exactly where she thought she would be. But she is a hopeful kind of, I think she's quite lost. In the beginning of the book, readers will find her lost and trying to find somewhere that she thinks she should be. So she wants a home and she wants someone to love her. She wants someone to love, and she just kind of wants what she thinks everybody else has. And the book opens with her in quite a unfortunate sort of circumstance. She is in love with her best friend, and she thinks he's going to tell her the same, but actually he asks if she will be his best woman for his wedding. So that's where the book begins.
The guy in the story, I don't want to give too much away. No. Maybe you should say can we say who the guy is and how they met or not?
Yes, I mean, they met when Emmy was 14 and she let go of a balloon into the sky, exactly as I described when I was at school. And Lucas, who is the main character in Dear Emmy Blue, he is the one that finds it. And this is where the story begins, when they're just both about to turn 30, and it's sort of when he found the balloon, it sort of stemmed this friendship that lasted 14, 15 years.
Oh, lovely. Great yes. idea. And was it fun coming up with the different characters and their relationship and everything because of this moment?
Yes. And I think I'm really interested in how a moment can kind of change a whole life. And I think that is pretty much the sort of leaping point from anything I ever write. It's all about how a person has got to this point and how a decision can kind of, if he had never found the balloon, if someone else had found it, they may have just thrown it away, they may have ignored it, but it's just like right place, right time. And it was really nice sort of trying to think about how that moment would have changed the kind of landscape or path of each of the characters in the book. But yeah, that is always the fun bit, is coming up with who are these people, what makes them tick, what are their histories. But yeah, that's always, I think that is probably my favourite part of the whole process.
Yeah. And do you have a clear idea at the beginning? So you had the gem of the idea with the letting go of the balloon and somebody finding it. So is that all yes. you need to start the book, or did you plan a lot more than that?
I had to plan a lot more. I think I had the idea of, wouldn't it be wonderful if you let go of a balloon and the person that found it was actually someone you really hit it off with, whether it be romantically or in a platonic way. But I thought it's not enough. It needs conflict and it'll need a lot more. And I think sometimes you need to rush it because you need to write the next book and you need to sit down and look at pen, you know, put pen to paper, look at it in the eye and say, what is this book trying to be? But other times it's nice to sort of just let the idea kind of just sit in your brain and eventually little things will come. And that's kind of what happened with Dear Emmy Blue. Just little morsels occasionally would arise in my, I don't know, the creative side of my brain, whatever happens in the weird thing that is my brain. And and eventually the story did build. But yeah, I always try to have a bit of a plan before I sit down to write anything. Otherwise, I can very easily just talk myself away from the desk, like, oh, I'll just go and have a cup of tea, it'll be all right. Whereas if you have a plan, it's sort of nice to sit down and say, okay, well, I'm not really in the mood to write today, but I know what I've got to write. And that is almost half the battle, I think.
Yeah. And you have to be very, very organized, I'm sure, with your time. I mean, I'm sure there's people listening to this show who feel like they have a book in them, but just can't find the time to write this
yeah.
book. And you said you've got three children and you've written two books in a year. I mean, that's amazing. How are you doing it?
Oh goodness, I don't know. I've got 4-year-old twins and an 8-year-old, and it's getting easier of course as they get older, but I think I always used to wait for, because I for years wanted to write a book and kept saying like, it was something I would do one day someday, and then I just think you realize as the years go on that there never is a perfect time for anything. And I always had this vision in my head, oh, I'll write a book when my house is empty and it's completely tidy and I have nothing to do and I can just sit at a desk with a cup of coffee and I can just write this beautiful masterpiece. And then I thought, that's never ever going to happen. And you kind of realize after talking to lots of other writers that books kind of get written in, okay, well, I have a friend who wrote most of her book on her commute to work, so that kind of half an hour on the train, she would think, well, I could either sit and scroll on my phone or I can get 500 words down. And that's kind of how I write. I just have to think, well, I've got an hour, do as much as I can in that hour, and then when the kids go to bed at night, if I've got another 2 hours. And treating it like something, I always say this, but just treating it like that glass of wine or like that hot bath, like this is something for me and me only, and it's a kind of a nice treat, I think.
Oh, it's lovely that you can see it as that. You know, it's supposed to be fun. If it's yes. a chore, then that's half the reason why people don't do it, I suppose.
Yes, exactly. And I think also a lot of the reason that sort of someone might not finish a book is because you're waiting for it to be perfect, you're waiting to, well, it's not good enough, so I'm not good enough, I can't do this. And actually, if you do, just as you say, have fun and just do what you can in that hour, it doesn't matter if you think it's rubbish or you think you don't really know what you're doing, you can edit. And it's just getting that initial really rough draft down, and I think once you've got to that end, you can then just take your time polishing it. And that's the more, I think that's the I mean, I say that's the fun bit, but every time I get to the next stage, I always want the stage before. It's like, I don't know, it's like rose-tinted spectacles. You look back and say, oh, I love writing a first draft. But while I'm writing a first draft, I'm always thinking, this is so hard. you're right. It's you have to enjoy it. You do. You have to have fun with it.
Yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of your latest book, it's called Dear Emmy Blue, and it's available on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section there. It's by Leah Lewis, who we've been chatting to. Leah, thanks so much for joining us again.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was lovely.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.